Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Middle Ground, Indians, Empires, and Republics in the Great Lakes Region, 1650-1815, by Richard White. Narrated by Bob Sauer. Publisher's Note: This audiobook will refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Preface to the 20th Anniversary Edition. It has been 20 years since I wrote The Middle Ground, and since then the book has led an interesting life without me. It has jumped disciplines, moving into literary criticism, anthropology, archaeology, and political science, and it has traveled the world, not just to other parts of North America, where I expected it to go, but also to Africa, Asia, Australia, and Europe. And it is time-traveled all the way back to antiquity in some cases. I recognized soon after the book was published and achieved its initial success that what was good for a book might not be so good for its author. The danger in my case was that I would be trapped in the book and would spend the rest of my career sitting as the judge in the court of the middle ground. I would have to rule on whether any given example dragged into my court was an actual middle ground or a set of ordinary compromises posing as something grander. There were several reasons why I wanted no part of this. The first was that the suspects came from worlds that I often knew little about. It took me 10 years to write The Middle Ground, and the joy of it was the basic pleasure of writing any history. I went to places that seemed strange to me, and gradually the people there came alive and familiar enough so that they seemed more real to me than the people among whom I passed my days. This worried my wife. It still does. But I did not know nearly so well the worlds of these suspects from Africa, Asia, South America, Australia, New Zealand, and more. How could I judge whether they, too, created middle grounds? I had my suspicions, of course, but not enough to acquit or convict. The second reason for my hesitation was purely practical. I had other things to do. I have been, professionally at least, a lucky man. There is more that I want to research than I will ever be able to explore. I want the books that I write to speak for themselves so I can go on to other things. As soon as it was published, The Middle Ground was largely on its own. The final reason was based on neither my ignorance, like the first reason, or my selfishness, like the second, but on what I understood the concept to be. The Middle Ground is a book about, among other things, mutual misunderstandings and the ways that new meanings are derived from them. It is about the virtues of misreading. This puts an author who acts as a judge and accuses his readers of misreading in an awkward position. This is not to say that there have been misreadings of the book. I think there have. But one of the things that I learned in writing the book was that such misreadings can be fruitful in their own right. Those scholars who have used and critiqued the concept of the middle ground have done me a great honor and a great service. They have helped me to clarify my own thinking about the concept. I can refine my own use of the term without claiming that I am the final judge of its use, or that there are no other quite legitimate, and perhaps even more useful, ways to employ the concept. By middle ground, I meant, I realized in ways that I did not fully grasp when writing the book, two twinned things. First, I was trying to describe a process that arose from the willingness of those who sought to justify their own actions in terms of what they perceived to be their partner's cultural premises. Such actors sought out cultural congruencies, either perceived or actual. These often seemed and indeed were results of misunderstandings or accidents. Such interpretations could be ludicrous, but it did not matter. Any congruence, no matter how tenuous, can be put to work and take on a life of its own if it is accepted by both sides. This was and is a process of mutual and creative misunderstanding. But in developing this idea, I did not always separate it from a second aspect of the middle ground. I was trying to describe, and this took up the bulk of the book, a quite particular historical space that was the outcome of this larger process. This space was the Pays de l'Homme, Because the middle ground is itself a spatial metaphor, the term has allowed a conflation between the process of expedient and creative misunderstanding and the actual space that I was discussing, the Pays de l'Homme, or the upper country of French Canada. I think I was fairly specific about the elements that were necessary for the construction of such a space. A confrontation between imperial or state regimes and non-state forms of social organization, a rough balance of power, a mutual need or a desire for what the other possesses, and an inability of one side to commandeer enough force to compel the other to do what it desired. Force and violence are hardly foreign to the process of creating and maintaining a middle ground, but the critical element is mediation. The mediation process is something more than compromise. If all the middle ground meant was compromise between opposing interests, then it would be a concept with little or no utility because compromise is widely recognized by scholars, political actors, and the general public. Why invent a new name for it? A middle ground is the creation, in part through creative misunderstanding, of a set of practices, rituals, offices, and beliefs that, although comprised of elements of the group in contact, is as a whole separate from the practices and beliefs of all of those groups. In a partial sense, it is a form of what Lévi-Strauss referred to as a bricolage, using materials at hand to overcome a new obstacle. But Lévi-Strauss, as I will discuss later, also set limits on what bricoleur could do and the tools available to them that makes the middle ground something more than his concept of bricolage. I always thought that the middle ground as a process was present in other places and other times. I did not, however, think that every time you find this process at work, you would find the construction of a coherent space that is the equivalent of Pays de l'Homme. There are instances in which the process can be evident, but the space may fail to emerge. The French penetrated deep into North America, and west of the Missouri River, many of the practices of the middle ground, alliance chiefs, the Calumet ceremony, gift exchanges, Catholic missionaries, went with them. There were, too, numerous examples of expedient and creative misunderstandings, but there was no long-lasting equivalent of Pays de l'Homme. The space of the middle ground depended on the creation of an infrastructure that could support and expand the process, and this infrastructure was possible only when there was both a rough balance of power and a mutual need between the parties involved. Middle grounds as coherent spaces were difficult to produce, but I am not surprised that scholars have found other areas of the Western Hemisphere that contain middle grounds, as has, for example, Claudia Garcia, who has employed the concept in studying the Mosquito Indians at the end of the 17th century. The ways in which the processes of the middle ground produce coherent spaces equivalent to the Pays de l'Homme do not have to follow the exact model that I described in The Middle Ground. I am perfectly willing to admit that the process of the middle ground and what Jonathan Lippmann in his Familiar Strangers, A History of Muslims in Northwest China calls a place in which peoples adjust to their differences while positioned between cultures do not necessarily depend on an exact replication of the sequences of development in the Pays de l'Homme or a reliance on the same or even similar institutions. When Lippmann finds a long process of sometimes expedient, sometimes deadly mutual misunderstandings, I feel like I am in familiar territory, even though I know nothing except what Lippmann tells his readers of the Muslims in his particular section of Northwest China. I have been particularly pleased when other scholars underline aspects of the process that I recognized but did not fully explore and make their own original use of it. I have long admired and used the work of James C. Scott, but when he in The Art of Not Being Governed emphasizes the case for beginning with the elementary unit of the household and treating villages, tribes, and confederations as provisional and shaky alliances, he underscores a particular aspect of the Pays de l'Homme that, although he credits me with using it to brilliant effect, he uses far more effectively. He takes my sometimes naive empiricism and turns it into a much more formidable comparative analysis with fuller theoretical insight. Scott is interested in zones of insubordination, particularly shatter zones in which fragments of larger groups seek sanctuary and opportunity beyond the reach of states or conquerors. His larger project is an attempt to understand Zomia, a name for an area that includes the highlands of Southeast Asia in Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, and Burma, but stretches into India and includes four Chinese provinces. These areas were used as a refuge over centuries for people in flight from state-making projects who came to form a vast state-resistant periphery. He links Zomia to similar regions of refuge in Latin America, Brazil, the Andes, and elsewhere. In Zomia, as in the Pays d'Enhant, identities are often plural, local groups are often autonomous, and groups readily fragment. I am nearly as pleased when people fail to find a middle ground as when they do, for a negative finding also involves an effort to take the concept seriously. Henry Reynolds states flatly that there was no middle ground in Australia. The concept is imperial in that it is often found in the company of empires, but I never had imperial ambitions for the concept itself. After all, if the middle ground was everywhere, then it might as well be nowhere at all. The best historical concepts are those that are good to think with, and when I find scholars actively engaging the concept, rigorously applying it to their own material, and then explaining why what they found was not really a middle ground, I am proud of the book. It is doing its work well. In a book such as Pekka Hämäläinen's recent The Comanche Empire, no middle ground emerges, but to the extent that the concept helped Hämäläinen refine his own ideas about the quite interesting and important social formation that he found in Comancheria, it did its work well. When the concept of the middle ground has moved over into other disciplines, the scholars using it have usually, but not always, been concerned with American Indian peoples. Literary critics such as Emilia V. Katansky have found emergent middle grounds in Indian boarding schools and used the concept to interpret texts about these boarding schools. And Hartvig Isernhagen has found echoes, but hardly a recreation, of the middle ground in Federal Writers Projects texts from the 1930s and 1940s in the Midwest. And scholars have found the middle ground useful in describing contemporary political developments. Beth A. Conklin and Laura R. Graham found the concept useful in understanding environmental conflicts in the Amazon, particularly in arenas where Amazonian Indians and environmentally concerned outsiders interact. Their middle ground is a political space, an arena of intercultural communication, exchange, and joint political action. The book has hardly been uncontroversial, but the attacks on it, both implicitly and quite explicitly, have not led me to change my mind about the concept itself or its particular manifestation in the Pays d'Enhant. If anything, they have hardened my position because I think there are very important issues at stake. I have no intention of answering all the criticisms of the middle ground. I am perfectly content to have readers determine the merits of such critiques, but I will address two works that raise larger issues about both the nature of relations between empires and pre-state societies and the possibilities of cross-cultural understanding and accommodation. These are issues of considerable importance and continuing interest to me. The major empirical attack on the middle ground has been from Giles Havard, who, surveying the early period covered by the book, asserts, in effect, that there was no middle ground in the Pays d'Enhant. Havard also makes an interesting theoretical attack. The strongest conceptual attack, however, has come from James Merrill. Our books share some common figures, but he only touches on the fringes of the Pays d'Enhant, and he barely mentions the middle ground. He does, however, challenge the possibility of successful mediation and the creation of the common world that I describe. Havard makes his most detailed criticism of the middle ground in his Empire en métissage, Indien et Français dans le Pays d'Enhant, 1660 to 1775, and a second more nuanced criticism in his recent review of the French edition of my book. Havard is a formidable scholar, and Empire et métissage is an impressive book. But its argument of a Pax Gallica and French mastery is in many ways a reconceptualization of exactly the concept of imperial power and dominance that I set out to critique in The Middle Ground. To the extent that Havard recognizes the operation of a middle ground, he sees it only as a tool of French manipulation of Indians. Indeed, he regards interpretations that stress Indian manipulation of Europeans as an imposition of a Western point of view on Indian actions that proceed from quite different cultural premises. When Havard argues that mediation itself can be an instrument of power, I do not disagree. This is one of the theses of the middle ground. The book does not deny the power of empires, but rather it limits and complicates that power. Where Havard and I differ is in seeing mediation as a French invention and imposition. Mediation had European equivalents, but its forms and inspiration in the Pays d'en Haut were largely native. As Bacqueville de la Poterie, also known as Claude Charles Leroy, noted in his Histoire de l'Amérique septentrionale, the Potawatomis were the original mediators and rivals of the French. European politics of empire persisted, but the alliance, as I argued, merged the French politics of empire with the kinship politics of the village. Far from being a simple tool of empire, mediation was a time-consuming, expensive, often frustrating endeavor that French officials, particularly those new to Canada, often rebelled against. As Louis-Antoine de Bougainville complained, it was a work of eternal little detail, petty, and one of which Europe has no idea. Mediation was power, but in the Pays d'en Haut it was a paradoxical power. The French were at their strongest when they appeared, at least to themselves, the most weak. When they offered goods freely, when they mediated quarrels, when they stayed Algonquian hatchets and covered the dead, then they achieved a status that no other group could rival. They were, conversely, at their weakest when they appeared the most dangerous and powerful. When Onoscio, either for his own reasons or at the urging of his allies, abandoned mediation and deployed force, then his special status began to dissipate. One welcomed a kind father, one sought protection against a vengeful father. The logic of the alliance could not easily encompass a father who participated in, rather than settled the quarrels of his children. Havard not only wants to resurrect a quite old-fashioned imperialism in which Europeans always command, but he also appeals to a now old-fashioned structuralist anthropology rooted in a simplification of the more problematic assumptions of Claude Lévi-Strauss. Havard has caused me to return to the work of Lévi-Strauss, who at one point had a great influence on my thinking, and whose work and boldness I admire. When Havard accuses me of ignoring the differences between hot societies, historical, progressive, cumulative, and cold societies, so-called primitive societies removed from history and progress and devoted to cyclical repetition, he is right. I do not accept rigid distinctions between people of history and people both without history and who refuse to understand their experiences historically. The societies that created the middle ground were hybrid. They certainly have ritual means to deny the disruptions of history, to restore all to a balanced and anterior state. But not only are these rituals themselves very often new and historical, but they could be consciously created and manipulated to achieve new ends. They were meant to shape events and create, if necessary, new structures. I think virtually all societies contain aspects of cyclical and historical thinking, but in this I am not that different from Lévi-Strauss at his more nuanced. Lévi-Strauss was a brilliant, complicated, and, over the course of a long life, not always consistent thinker. His structuralism made him inclined to begin with binaries, and he certainly believed that the characteristic feature of the savage mind is its timelessness. Its object is to grasp the world as both a synchronic and a diachronic totality. His views became more nuanced and complicated over time. It is easy to miss this nuance because the connotation of the very term savage mind, the English title of his classic work, distorts his arguments. He intended to distinguish between ways of thinking, mythical or wild on the one hand and scientific on the other, in all human beings rather than create a typology of societies. But because virtually all of his examples were drawn from pre-modern and non-state societies where his wild thinking predominated, it became very easy to read him as creating a dichotomy between savage societies and the civilized. He had so often to deny the accusations of formalism and idealism leveled against him, and to cite his advocacy of historical interpretations because his histories sometimes seemed so hypothetical and his categorical thinking was so pronounced. To see an historian such as Havard citing the more ahistorical aspects of Lévi-Strauss is doubly odd. First, because the received idea of Indian peoples as being either a people without history or a cold society incapable of thinking historically would seemingly be the first thing an historian would question, and second, because it neglects the odd dance Lévi-Strauss did with history. He embraced it in one place and implicitly denied its reach in others. He defined the ambition of the historian as striving to reconstruct the picture of vanished societies as they were at the points which for them corresponded to the present, while the ethnographer does his best to reconstruct the historical stages which temporally preceded their existing form. Typically, he began with a simple binary division. Anthropologists studied diversity in contemporary space. Historians study diversity across time. This is a division of labor few modern historians would accept, but neither is it one that Levi Strauss clung to very consistently. He often made a more expansive history part of his anthropology. In a 1960 interview, Levi Strauss clarified his explanation of what he meant by a hot society. "We try to define," he said, "ourselves in opposition to our ancestors. Change is thus much more rapid. We are not only aware of the existence of history, but we wish, with the knowledge we have of our past, to reorientate the future, legitimize or criticize the evolution of our society. Hot, in this sense of ourselves as living in a world different from our ancestors and using the knowledge we have of our past to reorientate the future, is quite close to what many historians mean when they use the term modern. Hot and cold societies were, to Levi Strauss, poles, and actual societies existed along a continuum. He did not intend to describe societies with utterly discrete and incommensurate ways of thinking. A fundamental thrust of the middle ground is to assert that Indian peoples in the Pays d'En-Haut were modern, a people of history whom events had forced to charter a new and dangerous route into the future. They were not captured and imprisoned in some state beyond history. I do not expect that Levi Strauss would have agreed with me, but neither would I expect him necessarily to take Havard's position. When Levi Strauss attacked Sartre for creating an ahistorical prison in which each subject's group and period now takes the place of timeless consciousness, and for the egocentricity and naivety of thinking that existential truth lies in a single historical epoch in the West, he was arguing for porous and social boundaries and comprehension across time and space. In 1952, with the shock of World War II and fascism still quite fresh, Levi Strauss wrote a little book, a pamphlet really, for UNESCO entitled Race and History. Parts of it are now quite dated, but much of it remains compelling and fresh. Embedded in it is an argument against the idea of cultures as hermetically sealed containers incapable of a true judgment of any other, since no culture can lay aside its own limitation. His ideas of how colonized peoples adjust to the presence of colonizers were sketchy, schematic, and anecdotal, but he clearly recognized that the results were in large part a product of power, and that in conditions of roughly equal power, societies adjusted without necessarily surrendering their Weltanschauung. But more than this, he asserted that all cultural progress depends on a coalition of cultures, and that the paradoxical challenge of historical change is that human progress, in the widest sense, depends on both overcoming difference through coalitions and reproducing difference, because human vitality depends on diversity. In this very broad sense, what Levi Strauss thought as the modern challenge was the one prefigured in the Pays d'En-Haut and on the middle ground. Whether I cite a debt to or a difference from Levi Strauss thus depends on what particular aspect of his thought is at issue. When he deals in typologies, then I make little use of his work, but he often creates concepts and metaphors that can be expanded beyond his own use of them. His idea of bricolage is a brilliant metaphor, but to the extent that he imagined it as a mark of a closed system in which those within are unable to imagine the kind of design and technique that he takes as a mark of science, then the concept is not very helpful to me. But there is no reason that bricolage has to be kept pure and confined to pre-modern societies. Bricolage can reach out to include new elements, including those Levi Strauss marked as modern or scientific. In such combinations, it can create the kind of calculated change that we see as a mark of modernity. A leader such as Tecumseh could be, for example, considered a bricoleur, but he was also modern and revolutionary. James Merrill's critique of the middle ground in his book Into the American Woods is more implicit than explicit. It is in some respects virtually the opposite of Havard's, because where Havard sees overwhelming colonial power and portrays mediation as a successful European tool that ensured domination, Merrill portrays mediation as relying heavily on Indian diplomatic practices. And in the broadest sense, Merrill's trajectory of Indians as a people who once mattered to Europeans because they were both threatening and necessary, but who became specimens to be pitied or studied, is the trajectory of the middle ground. In its ultimate implications, however, it is quite similar, because he too questions the possibility of accommodation in contests between imperial powers and non-state actors. But on the Pennsylvania frontier, an area on the edges of the Pays d'En, Merrill sees no evidence of a middle ground and regards mediation as ultimately a failure. The mediators themselves were unable to see past their differences in order to embrace their similarities. If all Merrill contended was that mediation failed and no middle ground emerged in Pennsylvania, it would hardly count as a critique of the middle ground, because I never claimed that the whole colonial world was the Pays d'En, and my middle ground emerged among the French, not the British. But Merrill's study is not so easily dismissed. Some of the figures in his book, the Montours, George Croghan, are also central figures in mine. But again, it is entirely possible that people who succeed in one arena fail in another. What is more significant is that Merrill not only blames the failure in part on the mediators, but also sees misunderstanding and distrust as simply dead ends. In Pennsylvania, he finds that misunderstanding and mistrust ruled. Misunderstanding and mistrust also ruled in the Pays d'En, but they were put to creative uses. For Merrill, however, misunderstanding and mistrust seem incapable of generating anything beyond misunderstanding and mistrust. There was no possibility of mutually comprehensible worlds. The very tools, treaties and councils, designed to create a common world made it impossible. The paths through the woods led nowhere. In order to make sure that Merrill and I are not talking past each other, it is best to reiterate my position in the middle ground and understanding between cultures. One of the books that most helped me in thinking about the middle ground was Greg Denning's wonderful Islands and Beaches. Denning was quite literally describing contact along the beaches of Polynesia, but he turned it into a metaphor of contact zones, beaches, and the existing native cultures not fully visible from the beaches. In the middle ground, I was far less interested in examining the interior cultural world, the native islands, than in exploring the beaches from which the vast majority of surviving historical sources survive. In Denning's terms, the middle ground was a kind of beach. A native world existed beyond it and was sometimes visible from it, but the existence of the beach did not depend on Europeans fully grasping or sympathizing with what went on within the island. The middle ground did not involve the achievement of a widespread mutual understanding and appreciation between Europeans and Indian peoples. People did not come together to love one another, nor does the concept of a middle ground envision the elimination of either native cultures or of European cultures and their replacement by some common hybrid. I presume the persistence of many aspects of the old alongside the creation of the new. As I wrote, although identifiable Frenchmen and identifiable Indians obviously continued to exist, whether a particular practice or way of doing things was French or Indian was, after a time, not so clear. This was not because individual Indians became Frenchified or because individual Frenchmen went native, although both might occur. Rather, it was because Algonquians, who were perfectly comfortable with their status and practices as Indians, and Frenchmen, confident in the rightness of French ways, nonetheless had to deal with people who shared neither their values nor their assumptions about the appropriate way of accomplishing tasks. They had to arrive at some common conception of suitable ways of acting. James Merrill and I share the same question. Can the peoples of two different cultures understand each other to a degree that they can accommodate their differences? In two similar historical contexts, we not only arrived at different answers, but seemed to be looking for different things. I contend that in the Pays d'En, the French and the people I lumped together as Algonquians created a hybrid world that, although derived from existing French and Indian worlds, was something new. I don't claim the two groups did this by understanding and appreciating the other's cultural perspective, but rather I claim they did it by capitalizing on creative misunderstandings. Merrill seems much more focused on seeing mutual understanding as the route to accommodation. In this regard, Meryl and I are looking at two different and incommensurate things, and I could leave it at that, but to do so would slight the very serious issues that Meryl raises. In a single sentence at the end of his book, perhaps written more for effect than anything else, he took a question about the impossibility of Indians and white people living together on the Pennsylvania frontier without a perpetual scene of quarreling and universalized it across all American history. In contrast to his careful consideration of the Pennsylvania woods, he offered no evidence for this. He mentioned Wounded Knee, indicated that nothing has changed in the 20th.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?